Broadcasting live from the Buckhead Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Legal Experts.
Good morning, all you AL fans out there. It's Emily Rowell with Peachtree Offices here hosting another show of Atlanta Legal Experts Radio. We're excited that you're listening and tuning in this morning. Thank you so much. We appreciate the support. And today we have a great lineup. We have Ann Tyler Hamby with Hamby Benefits Law. Good morning. How are you this morning?
Great.
Good.
Glad to be here.
She specializes in employee benefits legal compliance, and we're excited to hear a little bit about that. Lots of interesting stuff that she's got in store for us. And Joe Neal, back again.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. With Neal Law, he's a Georgia trial lawyer that has over two decades of litigation experience. We appreciate you coming on and giving us some insight into that.
Looking forward to it.
Absolutely. And Beth Gearhart with the Gearhart Law Group. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming on. You do workers' comp.
Yes.
So you will tell us what to do if we get hurt on the job, which is, of course, very important.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And we have sponsors today, 3A Law Practice Management, helping lawyers start and build their practice, and Peachtree Offices, helping lawyers work virtually anywhere from virtual offices, addresses, all the way to physical office space. And we have Josh Schiffer today as my special co-host.
Thanks so much for having me back, Emily. I really enjoy coming down here. My name is Josh Schiffer from Chanko Schiffer Law. You can always look us up online. Just Google me. Josh Schiffer, spelled just like the model. I don't look anything like.
Tell me about your practice, Josh.
Yeah, well, we've been a real success story here, hand-in-hand with Peachtree Offices. I worked at the state for a number of years after my clerkship, where I met my partner, Doug Chanko, and we used to fight all the time because we were on other sides of the aisle. After fighting each other for so long, we figured out that it'd be good to get into bed together and represent individuals. So that's what we do primarily with personal injury and criminal defense. A lot of drug and alcohol law in my pet practice area is domestic violence related. I'm one of the few lawyers that will represent both victims of domestic violence along with the alleged perpetrators. I kind of eat from the whole stretch of the trough. Mm. And my firm's a big success because of the people over here at Peachtree Offices. Your office solutions here have really been one of the keystones to why we went from just solo practitioners with nothing up to a fully functioning, pretty well-regarded boutique law firm in the heart of Buckhead.
Well, thank you so much. That was awesome.
It's great to be here today. We've got some fantastic guests. I'm really familiar with two of them, and I'm really excited to hear from our very first guest.
Yes, Ann Tyler Hamby. Good morning again.
Good morning. Happy Tuesday.
Yes, happy Tuesday. Thank you for being here. Let me just start with your bio. Ann Tyler Hamby is the owner of Hamby Benefits Law, LLC, a law firm specializing in retirement plans, health and welfare benefits, and executive compensation law, with a focus on serving small and mid-sized companies in the Atlanta area. Prior to forming Hamby Benefits Law, LLC, Ann Tyler Hamby practiced employee benefits law with Alston & Byrd, LLP, and King & Spalding, LLP, two of Atlanta's largest firms. She earned a Master of Laws in Taxation with distinction from Georgetown University Law Center and her Juris Doctor from the University of Alabama School of Law. Ann Tyler earned a Master of Science in International Development from the University of Bath. She earned a Bachelor of Science in Finance and Economics, magna cum laude, from Birmingham Southern College. I can't even say it all. And you did it. That's awesome. And you would obviously know what you're talking about just because of this background. I'm excited to hear more. So tell us a little bit about yourself first. How did you get to where you are? And did you grow up in Atlanta?
I did not grow up in Atlanta. I grew up in a town near Muscle Shoals, Alabama.
Okay.
Has a rich music heritage, as some of you have seen the documentary that recently came out. So went to school in Birmingham. My bio is college in Birmingham, and then spent a year abroad in England, which was great, and then lived in Washington, D.C. for a few years.
Okay.
And settled for my first law firm experience at Alston & Byrd here in Atlanta.
Gotcha.
Good, in the South, but larger metropolitan city, so a lot of Atlanta.
And that's obviously one of the most prestigious firms in the Southeast. That's quite an accomplishment just to be recruited by a group like that, and it certainly gave you a great background for what you do now.
Absolutely, absolutely. Very grateful for the experience. And I primarily worked with Fortune 500 companies, helping companies through complex ERISA legal problems. And particularly companies that were being bought or sold, and then helping companies be proactive about getting their ERISA legal compliance issues in order.
So tell me a little bit, just kind of summarize ERISA law to the general audience for me.
Yes,
mean people.
If you can.
Won't give me no breaks.
Yeah, it's ERISA stands for the Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974, and it's basically a body of law that is meant to provide minimum standards for your retirement pension plans and your health and welfare benefit plans. And it's codified in the Department of Labor regulations and then correspondingly in the Internal Revenue Code. So there's a little bit of overlap in my practice with tax law and then labor employment law. So I get a lot of referrals actually from employment attorneys and corporate attorneys because we're kind of wedged in between those two practices. We're a niche within that.
I see. Now tell me, did you decide to specialize in this law just basically because of your background?
I did. My background was finance and economics. I had two great tax professors in law school and got to Georgetown, was specializing in corporate tax, but Georgetown had a specialty within tax for employee benefits. And I liked the HR aspect of tax merging with helping companies build better business benefits.
Mm-hmm. And tell me, what would be one of the biggest mistakes you'd see small businesses make?
I think
when it comes to that.
Absolutely. So primarily working with in at Alston & Bird and King & Spalding, working with companies that were being bought and sold, we go through and find a lot of ERISA compliance issues and negotiate purchase price reductions. But until the company was bought or sold, or until the Department of Labor or the Internal Revenue Service came in and found an ERISA compliance issue, it really fell by the wayside for a lot of companies, a lot of businesses. And so I think being proactive, I always tell clients, good planning is much less costly than good reacting. And so being proactive about being compliant with, for instance, I'm helping a shipbuilding company with about 500 employees. They're growing rapidly. Getting them ready for Affordable Care Act, making sure that they can avoid the pay or play penalty, getting them in the best defensible position possible to avoid a penalty or an IRS or DOL audit penalty.
And I'm a small business owner. I run a little law firm, but I was never taught business law. And you say ERISA to me as a guy that, you know, I saw the class in the catalog at law school, but I was staying away from it. When is a business owner supposed to come and talk to somebody like you?
That's a good question.
Absolutely. And so I think exactly what I mentioned earlier, a shipbuilding company that is growing rapidly. So small companies, smaller companies, mid-sized companies that are growing or that want to make sure that they are in a compliant, defensible position with respect to their retirement plan. So their 401k plan, there are a lot of different ways that you can fall out of compliance, not following your plan document. And so making sure that on the front end, the company is aware of the compliance issues and in a defensible position. And also with the Affordable Care Act, that's been a lot of what I've been doing recently is helping companies prepare for Obamacare, Affordable Care Act compliance.
Now, I know that a lot of small business owners, such as myself, we really try to, you know, shoestring some of these issues along that we don't understand. I know how much ERISA can impact a business as I smile. What are some of the things that business owners really need to think about when they get to that size?
With respect to ERISA?
Yeah. What are some of the planning methods that need to go into place? What happens? What's the trigger point for bringing somebody like you in, and what can you do for my small business?
Well, in the Department of Labor, I moderated a session a few months ago with Robert Lewis, who is EBSA Regional Counsel, and he recommended annual checklists, annual compliance, making sure because, and this keeps me in business, but the compliance with the Internal Revenue Code, the Department of Labor, this ERISA body of law. It's a moving target. There are constant changes. And so making sure that if you're compliant at the beginning of 2015, that you're up to date then at the end or the beginning of 2016.
And this is kind of like the IRS, where if you fall behind, it just compounds and compounds.
It's a snowball. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So you definitely would need somebody like you, obviously.
Yes.
Because you would know. It's not that small business owners know these things. So they would need your professional advice.
Yes. I recently helped a multinational company with an Atlanta subsidiary. The Department of Labor came in, audited their financial statements, found those deficient, assess them a significant penalty. And so I was brought in to negotiate, to lead the negotiation and reduction of the penalty. Got an 80% reduction in the penalty.
Wow.
So there's real success in bringing in legal counsel in the event that a company is under a DOL or IRS audit.
Now, if I'm the CEO of a company, what part of my company are you actually going to be working with? Are you someone that worked with my accounting department, or are you part of my VP of operations? Who are you facilitating with within my corporate structure?
CFOs, I generally deal with CFOs and HR directors if the company has an HR director, director of HR. And so it's decision makers, but then also HR directors who are dealing day to day with the compliance.
And this actually goes into hiring as well, because the materials you specifically advise on are part of attracting a solid employee base.
Absolutely.
Can you help employers pick, choose, and devise the right HR solutions?
Absolutely. And that's a great point. Just helped an award-winning travel agency here in town. They have a very successful business, and they wanted to think about how to put away some more retirement assets. And so we worked on plan design for a cash balance plan. It's actually called a cash balance plan, in addition to their 401k plan. So we went through all the plan implementation, administration features, and I think they found it very helpful to know up front what the issues are, what the contribution levels and administration issues are up front. So absolutely I can assist and enjoy assisting clients with
sounds
plan
like you're very passionate, for sure.
I love what I do.
That's awesome. And can you work with startups then? Obviously.
Absolutely.
Would be great.
Those are great companies because they're growing quickly. And so startups, generally, if they are growing quickly, they need that assistance and how to think about developing effective benefit programs for their employees.
Well, I meet with startups almost every day, so we would definitely be able to share.
Absolutely. happy to assist. I enjoy, and I tell you, I love about having Hamby Benefits Law is getting to know my clients and what they are doing and these entrepreneurs.
And I was going to kind of go there because I remember you said that you had been in the large firm.
Right.
And now you've got your own practice and
right.
yourself. So you kind of made that transition. Can you tell me why?
Well, I enjoy, again, working in developing personal relationships with my clients. As thankful as I am for that large law firm experience and that background, I have more flexibility with my billable structure now to develop personal relationships with my clients and to get to know them and get to know what they're doing. And it keeps me passionate about what I'm doing because I deal with all these businesses that are growing and working hard. Mm-hmm. And so that drives my passion as well.
Tell me a little bit about the advantages of going with a small boutique practitioner for ERISA as opposed to some of these mega firms. You know, there's that big trend in the law right now of getting away from these historic legacy firms because they have big costs associated with them.
Absolutely.
And so I know that cost is upfront, but talk a little bit more about the other benefits a business owner can have with that personal relationship with a small practitioner.
Absolutely, and I think you hit the nail on the head. I think the advantage of a smaller law firm, a boutique law firm, is the flexibility in the billable structure. And then with that comes the ability to have time and flexibility to develop a relationship with the client because I don't do a very rigid billable hour structure. And so I think it serves the client better.
I think also my clients, and I think most small practitioners, their clients really appreciate the responsiveness of
Absolutely.
A small practitioner. You're not having to go through a filter of senior partner X says, no, I've got to do it in this way, and there's a workflow pattern over at this department. No, you are the person on the other end of the phone for your clients.
Absolutely. And I think that the rigidity of the large law firm, it's difficult for personal relationships and to really focus on serving the client's needs.
Well, we are so glad that you are here to share with us today. And we would love it if you would tell our listeners how they can reach you.
You can reach me. I have a Twitter account, a Facebook account, and I also have a website, Hamby Benefits Law. And my website is www.hambybenefitslawllc.com. And I have just moved to Peachtree offices. I'm very excited about that. And so I am a happy new resident at Peachtree offices.
Yes, awesome. Well, thank you so much again. And we are excited to have you.
Thank you.
Yes. So we're going to go to Joe Neal. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good old Joe.
What's happening?
Hey, brother. How you doing, man?
Good, man. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. How's deer season for you?
Oh, I'm not a hunter.
I could have sworn I saw you
on
Facebook.
Lover. I'm not a killer. Except for when I'm in the courtroom.
That's only legal in Alabama, man. You're in Georgia. Totally different experience in the woods.
I will go ahead.
I do got some boots, though.
Oh, man. I bet they're good looking.
They're 23 years old.
Let me make this official here. I'll go ahead and read your bio. Joseph R. Neal Jr. Esquire is an AV preeminent rated second generation Georgia trial lawyer with over 2 decades of litigation experience. Mr. Neal is the principal and founder of Neal Law, a law firm with offices in Atlanta and Augusta, which provides first class legal representation for victims of catastrophic injuries and wrongful death. Mr. Neal handles a wide variety of tort cases across the state of Georgia. His success as an aggressive and compassionate plaintiff's trial lawyer in trucking cases, fire and burn cases, and medical malpractice cases has led him to being inducted into the multi-million dollar advocates forum known as the Top Trial Lawyers of America and RU Ratings Best Attorney of America as Lifetime Charter Member. Wow.
Quite the CV, Joe. He just shows that to every girl at the bar, too. I'm certain willing to bet. Joe, it's awesome to have you back here, man.
Yeah, man, good to be back again.
Good to have you. I see you've been staying pretty busy here recently. You've been in court. Tell me what's going on.
Yeah, I have that motorcycle case we talked about last time.
Yes.
We're trying it down in McDuffie County. It ended up being a mistrial. It wasn't due to a hung jury.
Tell people kind of how...
The jury was on our side.
Tell people how a mistrial affects a case just kind of from a general...
Well...
10,000-foot view, or can you do that at this point?
Well, in cases that I deal with, which are either someone's killed or they're lifelong injured, it's a lot of money and a lot of time, so you don't want to have to retry a case. But sometimes that happens. It's very, very small percentage of cases. But, you know, we had a good trial. We tried a good case. The jury was with us. We had rested and had put on a super case, and we're on our way to what I felt like was a big, probably seven-figure verdict. And I was cross-examining the star defense witness about his lies in Vietnam. When I deposed him, I could tell by his demeanor and the way he answered questions that something was not right with this guy. And he claimed to have seen the whole wreck except for the actual impact, but he blamed everything on my client. Said he was on a crotch rocket screaming on the road, going 100 miles an hour, past people on WL lines, and then it had to be his fault, even though he got ran over by a drunk driver who fled the scene.
Wow.
But, I found out in discovery through the military records that he had lied about a Purple Heart and a Silver Star in Vietnam. So I was laying into him on cross-examination.
That is a federal crime now.
I was looking at the jury, and it was over. Nobody believed a word he said. And I sat down, and the defense lawyer got up, and he started trying to get back into his Vietnam experience and said, yeah, you were a cannoneer and you were a gunner. People that haven't – and I wasn't in the military, but I've researched this. That doesn't mean he fought. He was delivering munitions to the people that fought, and he was doing construction. But the guy was trying to imply that he was in combat in Vietnam, which he wasn't. So I made an objection. I said, Your Honor, he's opening the door to these federal citations I have in my hand. The judge didn't like that, granted a mistrial.
Wow.
And the reason is, this is a very esoteric point of law, and when I was researching this, nobody up here in Atlanta had ever really dealt with it. And it's something I discovered. There's a thing called the Federal Stolen Valor Act. If you lie on a government job application about military wars in Vietnam, it's actually a federal crime.
Yep.
It got thrown
relatively
out.
new crime.
Yeah, several years ago, I think it was passed when Bush was in office, and then it got thrown out by the Supreme Court as something to do with violating free speech. But then Congress redrafted it because it's such an abominable lie.
Well, it's one of those free speech connections like burning the flag. Nobody wants you to do it, but shoot, it actually is free speech to burn a flag. I'm just going to get real upset about it. Joe, I want you to talk about for a minute why it's important to have a real trial dog that goes out there and tries cases rather than one of these settlement guys that hasn't darkened the doorstep of a courthouse in 30 years.
You want me to tell you the truth?
Yeah.
This is a cold, dark world. And if you don't have someone that loves you, that really cares about you, they're just not going to do it the way it should be done. So I don't take cases unless I really like the client and believe in their story. Mm-hmm. I get to know them. And, you know, when I was trying this case, this is about Rodney. Rodney, I feel like he's my brother. I mean, this guy is salt of the earth. This ruined his career. He can't drive trucks anymore. He was an 18-wheeler driver and had a CDL for 10 years. And this drunk driver ran over him and, in fleeing the scene, ran over his leg and crushed his ankle and his tib fib bone. And, I mean, he's a cripple. He walks around like the Hunchback of Notre Dame.
And you can't handle 50 of these cases at a time. You can't handle 150, 200 files.
No way.
There's no way you're going to get that kind of success, the success that you demand for your clients, when you're one of these high-volume guys.
That's true. And, you know, the people that advertise on TV, the whatever, $1 color, whatever you call it, bada-bing, bada-boop, they don't ever go to court. They cast a big net, and all they're marketers.
Mm-hmm.
They are. They cast a big net, and then they pass them on to people like me and others that know what they're doing, and they just want a little cut of the action.
Right.
So, you know, I would never call someone on TV if you have a real injury, you know.
Right, right.
And there really is that huge difference between some of these fender bender, bump and grind, you know, little chiropractic case and a catastrophic injury. Tell people what you mean when you're talking about you represent victims of catastrophic injury.
Well, there's a lot of categories of injuries, but a catastrophic injury is one where it's basically ruined your life. You either can't work anymore or you can't do the job you did, and it's made you into a different person. And in Rodney's case, we're retrying the case March 5th, March 9th in McDuffie County. We had testimony from his relatives that he's just not the same person. You know, he's a self-made man, very strong, always did everything on his own, didn't ever ask anybody for help, and now he's helpless and he's destitute. And I cannot wait to get back into court because I love this man. And the people of McDuffie County that get on this jury are going to love this man because he didn't do anything wrong. He just got ran over by a drunk.
I was just talking with a colleague of mine about how you know that you're doing the right thing when you're losing some sleep over going out there and representing some of these injured people. Mm-hmm. Rodney's whole life is in your hands.
Oh, it's a huge burden.
What happens to Rodney if you don't succeed?
I don't even want to think that. I really don't.
I
mean, honestly, he should get Social Security disability, but he's probably not going to get it because he's too young. He's 48, and I know that's not young to most of us, but in Social Security, that's actually a little too young sometimes to get it.
Yeah, and I know that you get asked this question all the time. What about how does the money work on this? So many people that are injured are worried about going to a lawyer like you that has the history and credibility and integrity that you do and are worried about having to pay a whole bunch of money out of their pocket. How does that work? I know the system's got it set up so that you can do your job, but people don't understand that.
This is a great point, and it was really funny at the trial near the end. The jury comes in from Rebecca, and I'm sitting in the witness chair, and one of the jurors looked at me like, what are you doing in the witness chair? I started smiling. Well, we sought attorney's fees in that case because it was an egregious example of conduct by a defendant. You can't always seek attorney's fees, but I'm the type of lawyer that I don't charge someone unless I get the money. And it's a contingency fee. So that allows people like Rodney who have no money, who can't work anymore, to have access to the courthouse. And if I lose, then he doesn't have to pay me. And in this case, we've already spent $50,000, and we'll probably spend another $30,000 to retry it because we had six doctors as experts. Four of them were trauma surgeons. Two were PhDs. One of those was an economist. One was a vocational rehab. So these cases are very not just labor-intensive. I'm talking thousands of hours, but tens of thousands of dollars. And in that case, we sought attorney's fees, so the drunk driver would have to pay my client's bill. I didn't want him to have to pay me a dime. I want the drunk driver who did this to have to pay for it.
And I think,
hold on, and the truth is, behind the whole thing is a giant insurance company up in Ohio.
Yeah, no, and that's one of those things people don't understand.
It's really not the drunk driver, it's the insurance company.
Till they see these kinds of litigation, the people pulling the string in the background isn't necessarily the defendant. Defendant probably feels awful about whatever they did. Most of the time, these negligence cases really are an accident. It was caused by carelessness, issues like that. The defendant who's actually getting sued doesn't care. It's that big insurance company who's telling people to jump and step and fetch and all this other stuff. That's the people that we're really after in these cases.
And Josh, the more I have done this, I've been doing this now 20, what year is it? 15. It'll be 22 years in May. The more I've done this, the more I realize who my real opponent is. I'm suing the insurance company. Even though I'm having to sue the person that is insured, because under Georgia law you have to do that in almost 95% of the cases, you're really fighting the insurance company. They're calling all the shots, pulling all the strings, and I don't understand why they didn't settle this case. It makes no sense to me. Makes no sense.
And I want to be clear on something that Joe just said. These insurance companies are given the opportunity to make the client whole generally fairly early in the process. There are demand letters and estimates of medical costs and future damages and all this stuff. The only time these cases get to trial is when the insurance company and the plaintiff can't sit down and agree to something. And sometimes
they don't even want to talk to you.
Yeah.
And you keep on beating their ass and they still want to keep fighting. And you're like, do you really mean to do it again? Because I'm going to do it again. I'm not going to stop.
It is when you get these intractable defense positions where you see these headline verdicts. I know in the last month we've had a couple.
There's been a bunch of them.
There was 70-something million by Adamson up there on that little girl getting bit by the dog. I worked on that case. Joe Freed just got some big money on a SCAR, mm-hmm. where SCAR case generally isn't that big money. But if you end up with somebody intractable, you need a lawyer like Joe Neal to go out there and fight for you.
Yeah, I would think so. I'd like one like me. I've had lawyers before in domestic cases, you know, divorce. I really would like a lawyer like me because I fight for my clients.
Real quickly, will you tell people kind of what your services include and how that relationship works?
Everything. You pick up the phone, I'm going to answer it. I mean, I'm one-on-one. I'm not a big meal at all. And I take it through. I try to settle cases, but if they don't settle, we go to court. And I'm filing suit on probably 80% of my cases now because insurance companies just aren't paying money.
And how does a client know when to go and actually sue? When is it time to go to court? When is it time to go to
trial? The truth is, if you have a real injury and it's something that is keeping you from working and you're incurring medical bills, you need to get a trial lawyer up front because they can investigate the case, and if it ends up being in litigation, you need someone up front to gather the evidence and strategize, strategically plan your case out.
You have had cases against the government. Can you tell me?
Oh, yeah, many.
Tell me.
I'm a glutton for hard cases. I don't know what it is. I just the area of the law that involves what's called sovereign immunity or immunity has always bugged me. When I left the DA's office and I started practicing law with my dad doing plaintiff's work, I noticed that there's a body of law that they threw out cases all the time on immunity. What is immunity? Somehow, years later, I got drawn into that morass of immunity, and one of my longest-running cases was a burn case in Augusta involving two teenage lovers who were living in their first house together. It was a trailer, and it caught on fire while they were asleep because there was a defective kitchen light. It was missing a 5-cent plastic wire nut that you could buy at Home Depot because the landlord was too cheap. Mm. And anyway, a city inspector was supposed to have inspected the trailer, and he just pencil whipped it, did a drive-by, and didn't go inside. And it's like a final inspection, electrical. You go in, you look for smoke detectors, make sure there's no dangling wires. Well, he didn't do that, but he said he did. Georgia Power turns on the power. They get burned alive. It's the most horrible thing. Up until that point, I had some big cases, but that was nothing's like that.
Right.
It was a love story. But it was a tragedy, too. But anyway, that went on for 5 years, and we sued city inspector, Georgia Power, settled with the power company after 2.5 years, 40 depositions.
Wow.
They paid a good bit of money, and they've never been sued for that before. Then we kept going against the city inspector. We beat them on immunity in the trial court, the court of appeals, and the Supreme Court denied cert, and then that settled. And now I have a case right now in Atlanta, and the judge had to throw it out because the loss is immunity. And what happened was a little 12-year-old girl was going to the bathroom and got pulled into a room by some bad students who were not being supervised, and they sexually assaulted her. Mm. And so I sued the teachers for leaving kids in the class because I've talked to teachers and interviewed people and done research. There's a rule that says you cannot leave your kids alone at school. You can't leave the classroom. If you leave the classroom, you got to have a substitute teacher. Well, that got thrown out because the case law is horrible.
Teachers have
discretion to do everything. So anyway, we're appealing that to the Court of Appeals because it's just wrong. The law needs to be changed.
Yeah. Yeah, wow.
And I've got a couple of these sovereign immunity issues. That actually reminds me I should talk to one of you about one of them after this. When you go up to the state's lawyers, because they hire the same few law firms, there's one that's up in North Atlanta, or a little bit north of town. Tallest building in the little town. They're on the seventh floor. And the guy sits across from
you. The power structure, man.
The guy sits across from you at the fancy table, just turns around and says, Mr. Schiffer, I tell people all the time, you can't sue the state. You can't. You can try. I tell dead people's families all the time, you ain't going to be able to sue the state because that's in the state constitution. And he explained these just outrageous factual scenarios where it's so clear that someone did something amazingly negligent, stupid, and harmful that resulted in the death or injury of another. And the state's answer to that is, sorry, we're the state. I don't know if you've ever argued down there at the clerk's desk or something like that. Man, it's the same red-faced anger where you just turn around and go, are you kidding me? You did me this wrong, and you're just going to sit back and say, oops, I can't do nothing?
Let me tell you this. As a lawyer who not only tries jury trials, I also do appeals because I like to write. I'm a poet, and I just love literature. But anyway, I like to write, and so when I have to appeal my cases, I do. And I can tell you this, and most appellate lawyers and trial lawyers will tell you the same thing. Good facts make good law. So if you've got a really egregious factual situation and a chance to win it on the law or to change the law, pursue it because good facts make good cases. In that case with the two teenagers who got burned alive in the trailer fire, we made law in Georgia. That had never been a factual situation where the government got beat on immunity, and we made law, and the Supreme Court of Georgia said, we're not touching this. So it's the law now.
And among lawyers, that's really, I think, one of our proudest days. Any lawyer that's gone to the appellate court or the Supreme
Court. Had nothing to do about money.
Man, it's just cool to go home and look at your mom and your dad and say, look at what I did. They put my name down in the book as the guy that did this. And that is a feeling that not many other careers will share with you.
Well, you're laying down another brick in the road to justice for a victim who needs to be helped. And that case, hopefully, will help another lawyer who has another deserving client get past the immunity and get to a jury where it belongs.
When you find out that you've been shepherdized in somebody else's cool case, man, that's as nerdy as it gets, but it feels awesome when you are being quoted as somebody else is out there searching for their own brand of justice and your hard work gets brought into
and
it.
And that's why trial lawyers, we all like to share because we can't do it without each other. Honestly, we're David's fighting Goliath every day of the year.
I jokingly say that I ask God for an interesting life, and God has a hilarious sense of humor.
Because
the stuff that you see doing trial work is just unbelievable. It's unwritable fiction. You couldn't tell these stories if you had a million typewriters and a million monkeys. It just doesn't exist till it walks in your office.
Well, see, most normal people know, unlike lawyers that sometimes don't admit this, but the justice system is a cold, brutal system. And if you don't have an advocate who really cares about you, that's what it's going to be like. But I'm telling you, one of the greatest experiences I've ever had in my life is when I'm standing in front of a jury advocating on behalf of my client who his life has been ruined by something, and the jury comes back with that verdict. Mm. That is the truth, and it sets everything back in balance. And I swear to God, it's one of the greatest feelings I've ever had.
I bet. Well, we so appreciate you being here. I love to hear
your
stories.
Appreciate it.
And if you will let everybody know how they can reach you, being that you will answer the phone.
Yes. Well, I'll give you my website first so you can see what kind of cases I've handled. It's www.neal-law. That's neal-law.com. And my phone, which is also my cell, 706-829-6229. I'm on Lenox Road right between Buckhead and Midtown, so I'm in a real good location. And I go to people's houses. I go to hospitals. I make home visits.
And even if he's not going to toot his own horn, I will. Joe and I share membership in a couple real exclusive trial lawyers groups. Joe trains with the best of the best nationwide. Literally from coast to coast, there are these small get-togethers of the best lawyers in America that Joe gets invited to and he participates in, where that's how guys like Joe make the good cases out. They work really hard on them. They fight for their clients and they get outrageously good results. Joe really is, and the kind of guys like Joe, they're the ones that keep our system working for the little guy. If it's not for trial lawyers, the big business and the big government will just steamroll you.
And what we learn from Mr. Spence?
Oh, man, it all begins with you. That's absolutely what it is. It all begins with you.
And when we do these things, we're in the same tribe, ain't we?
Oh, man, it's unbelievable. That's how we know about these other fellas trying these big cases. We all knew about that dog bite case that there wasn't two nickels in it because there's no insurance, there's no nothing. Yeah. What they needed was little girl needed justice, $73 million later, and you're going to see new law come out of the legislature about these dangerous dog and abuse cases because this is a little girl whose arm got ripped off. She got horribly mauled by some dangerous dogs, and there's nothing to take care of her. We as society just threw her away. And, you know, they may not get a big payday. I know the lawyers didn't. I know the lawyers did it for nothing, took it as a loss.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
but hopefully there's going to be a real good message coming out of these bad facts. Makes them
That's
interesting
right.
law.
That's right.
I'm glad we gave you the opportunity to talk about that.
Sorry.
No, that's okay.
That's a hell of a verdict.
That's the whole reason.
Did you originate that one?
No. I worked on that at a seminar a year and a half ago where they were actually talking about maybe not going forward with it because there was just no money. And you know how big those investments – yeah. You know how big that investment gets. You just spent $50,000 on your case.
Yeah.
You can bet your spouse's income for the next year on these cases. Well, and if you lose – that's it.
Let me throw this out there, too, because this is important. Lawyers like me and Josh, sometimes we have to sell cars and tap into IRAs to finance cases. That's just the way it is, though.
Well, thank you so much for that. And I love that we have this option, this radio show. This is what it's all about.
Yep.
So to be able to talk about that. And we're going to go to Beth Gearhart. Thank you for being so quiet.
It's very interesting.
She's about to unleash now.
I'm a little bit, my area is not quite, it's not as fascinating with the big verdicts. And I'm kind of, you know, I'm kind of interested and I'm kind of jealous right now hearing about these really exciting cases. I don't do any personal injury.
Right, but I'm sure you guys would work together too.
Absolutely.
We do. We definitely do.
She does what I don't do and I do what she doesn't do.
Exactly.
Right. Well, let me tell you a little bit about Beth. She has over a decade of experience working with workers' compensation claims. Prior to moving to Georgia, she practiced in San Francisco. Having previously worked representing insurance companies, she is acutely aware of how claims are handled and defended. She now exclusively represents injured workers throughout Georgia, so you know about these insurance companies that they were talking about.
I do, and cold, hard world is definitely what I would use to describe it.
Mm. Yeah. So you worked for them before.
I did.
And now?
I did. I started out in San Francisco. I kind of fell into the area, and I liked it. I liked the medical aspect of it. I knew I wanted to always represent injured workers, but I wanted to get the good experience on the defense side so that once I made the switch over, I would know, you know, their game plan.
Right.
And then I moved to Georgia, which is an entirely different system. So same thing there. I got a job doing defense first, always with an eye of going out on my own. Of course, I didn't tell my employer that.
Of course.
but I needed to learn the system. It's entirely different in Georgia. And, you know, I spent a good amount of time working, and I know how they're going to value claims, the defenses, and it's probably, you know, they're probably not going to surprise me with anything, with their defenses.
Right. It makes you experienced. It lets you know what they're looking for your client so
right.
that you can fight them.
Right.
I love that. That is, I mean, how else can you do it?
It really, that background of working both sides of the aisle is so important. I oftentimes say my biggest regret in my career was not ever prosecuting. I do all defense work, and I never got that side, whereas both my partners, including a friend of yours, David Olson, mm-hmm. he goes back to his prosecution experience all the time, and then he did the same thing as you, worked for the other side, and that's made him a success on the personal injury. Will you explain to people exactly how personal injury and workers' comp are different? A lot of people, including a lot of lawyers, kind of think they're the same thing, but they're not.
Right. Basically, I mean, if you get hurt at work, I mean, it gets a little complicated, but if you're getting hurt at work, it's not typically a personal injury claim. It's a workers' compensation claim. You cannot sue your employer in tort and pursue a workers' compensation claim. It's usually a tort action is barred by what they call the exclusive remedy provision. Now, sometimes you can have both. Let's say you are a truck driver and you are rear-ended by another truck driver who is drunk. And you're working at the time. So you would have a workers' compensation claim against your employer insurer and possibly a personal injury claim against the other driver.
Mm-hmm.
We call that a third-party claim, right?
Yes. And that's when I call someone.
Yeah. She pointed at me.
Sorry.
Well, and at that point, y'all are working for the same client. You're just working on kind of two different tracks for recovery.
Yes. And a lot of times what happens is, you know, I have those going right now. And what happens is, you know, we pursue the workers' compensation claim. The personal injury claim may be kind of in the background. Mm-hmm. We kind of do the work comp claim and then, you know, see how serious it's going to be. See whether it's, you know, feasible to pursue it on a personal injury claim because they are expensive. So if it's going to be, you know, you got better in a week, it's probably not going to be, you know, worthwhile to pursue it. So we kind of see how it goes. You know, I have a case like that now where there is a potential, you know, defective product where my client was, you know, troubleshooting a machine that was like 700 pounds and it collapsed and fell on his pelvis.
Oh, no.
So, yeah. So now there's potential, you
that
know.
Person needs a real lawyer.
Products.
Like you.
Yeah. He has one, so that's good.
Products,
yeah. Yeah.
Product liability is a big deal.
That's a catastrophic injury. It can be.
It is. Yeah. So that's a products case as well.
And I know that a lot of times the workers' compensation is very rules-driven and very schedule-driven as opposed to kind of the wild and willy personal injury where you're just hanging out there for a couple years before throwing a suit together. Talk to me a little bit about the process of how workers' compensation cases start and kind of that timing, because it really is a different beast than traditional personal injury.
The process is a little strange, I'll be honest. It took some getting used to when I moved here, but basically, you know, you're going to report the injury. Hopefully, if the employer or insurer is going to accept the claim and pay you benefits, now that's a whole other issue of whether or not they are. But if they are, they're going to do, you know, you can't just go to whatever doctor you want to go to. If it's a what we call compensable workers' compensation claim, they should, although not always, have what's called a panel of physicians. It's at least six doctors, should be posted, should be explained to you. These are all shoulds because a lot of times they're not. And the injured worker should be given the choice of whom to go to. A lot of times I hear my clients, 9 times out of 10, well, they just told me to go to this occupational clinic. You know, you're supposed to be able to choose who you go to, and it's very dangerous when you start treating with somebody and, you know, and you don't choose. But basically, you know, we file for hearings, we put it into litigation with an administrative law judge, and we start a discovery process. But realistically, before your case gets to hearing, it's going to be several months.
Can you tell me, you mentioned a little bit, and I want you to kind of expand on some of the common mistakes the employers make when somebody's injured initially?
Common mistakes the employer makes is they don't explain, you know, the process to people. Right. Sometimes they don't even offer the medical treatment. They don't explain that panel of physicians. They don't have one posted, which is, you know, that's something that you're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a common problem that we see. A problem I see with the injured worker is that we don't have any proof they reported it.
And that reporting is a very important key beginning marker, correct?
It is, because they can defend, or, you know, they can deny the claim saying there's no notice. But now a lot of people communicate via text, email with their bosses. And if you have that, you know, put it in writing. And if you have a text to your boss and it says, hey, I fell down the hole, you know, I mean, it's great to have that evidence.
But what about when it's something that is kind of ongoing, like something you didn't really realize? Like, I had a relative that was working in a shop that she would have to go up and down stairs. And it was a weird because the counter was right there and the stair was right next to the counter. And she kept she would have to literally twist to get on the stairs every day. After a while, her back was hurting.
Right.
You know, just from doing that over and over again. So she didn't really think about it in the beginning because it wasn't really hurting until doing it every day.
Right.
So then what would you do at that point?
That's what we call, like, you know, a sort of cumulative trauma, you know, a claim that sort of builds up over time. And those claims in Georgia are really hard.
Yeah.
California, less so. We had separate actual cumulative trauma injuries. Here, it's very difficult. And I have many right now. And they're more often than not, the employer insurance company will deny the claim.
Does that include the repetitive stress injuries? I remember as a young man working in and around chicken plants in North Georgia.
Oh, yeah. The carpal tunnel.
Yeah, the carpal tunnel.
There's a lot of carpal tunnel in North Georgia.
The guys and the ladies that were typically fairly low-level sophistication, I specifically remember turning chickens into boneless, skinless chicken breasts involves a repetitive kind of scissor action.
Yep.
And these workers.
Damn, you're making me hurt, man.
Oh, man. You want to go visit.
Don't say that again.
You want to go visit Dante's Hell, chicken plant in North Georgia.
I don't
tough
want to.
Oh, I can imagine.
No.
But when they do this scissor action, eventually their thumbs would almost fuse into a claw. Is that something that workers comp? Because I knew there was a lot of litigation involved in some of those.
Oh, absolutely. And I think everybody knows about the chicken place in North Georgia. You're more likely to not have a claim denied there. But although, you know, it's hard to say. I think the most important thing an injured worker can do is you report it. Make sure the doctor puts that in the notes. Like, say, and make sure you tell them, listen, this hurts when I go to work and when I do this. And I noticed this after doing this for so long at work, because the insurance company is going to harp on, if you didn't mention that it's not in the record, they are not going to accept that claim. So get it, try to get it, you know, make sure you say it, make sure it gets in that record. You know, of course, with the chicken plants, I mean, insurance company has their go-to doctor that'll say, you know, oh, I don't think, you know, carpal tunnel can be caused by this. And then, you know, we have other doctors as well. So, but that's a common one.
Battle the experts.
That's what it is all the time.
But if it's, if that's part of your job, isn't that so much harder to fight? Because that's part of the job.
Yeah, it's really difficult. I mean, yeah. I have a client who did customer service work sitting at her computer all the time with her neck pain. And right. The doctors just don't, I mean, I have neck problems, so I know that sitting there can bother it because I experienced it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's very hard here in Georgia to get a doctor to relate it.
Well, I think one of the issues is that employers need to understand that if they require their employee to do something that results in an eventual injury, that employer is going to have to take responsibility for it. If you're asking right. someone to do something repetitive or to be placed in some situation where injury befalls the employee, it, most of the time that employer is going to be responsible for that, even if it is one of these cumulative injuries that's only caused by extraordinary repetition.
Right, or they should be.
Absolutely.
Yes.
This is an example of why someone who has a serious injury needs to get a good trial lawyer up front or workers' comp lawyer if it's working on, because you don't know this. You mm-hmm. don't know that the insurance company is not going to give any value to your claim out of what you're saying. They don't believe a word you say. So when mm-hmm. you give your history to your doctor, this is legitimate. It's part of the SOAP thing. You give him a history of what happened to you and you explain what happened so it's in the record that it happened at work. Otherwise, right. they're not going to believe you.
Right. Nope. So getting that attorney early on.
Yes.
So I would say that you really should, you work with obviously small companies, or who would be some good attorneys also besides the personal injury attorney that would refer you business?
You know, a lot of personal injury, mm-hmm. you know, people as well. I've even dealt with ERISA issues with my clients.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, it's gotten really complicated. I had a client who had a long-term and short-term disability, and there were offset and reimbursement issues, and it got really complicated.
They do not give you a discount. No. They don't have to either. And they're like, well, whatever.
They want their money back.
You. We will sell you.
Yeah.
Okay, here's a check. Go away.
Yeah, read the plan. And, you know, I realized that...
I don't want to read the plan because yeah. I don't like what it says.
Yeah. I realized this was over my head. This was not my area because sure, I do one thing, you know, and that's yeah. what I do. So I brought in an expert in that field to help me negotiate a settlement and make sure my client was protected mm-hmm. because of the benefits he's already received. And I didn't want them coming back and saying, hey, yeah. pay me back. Right. So, you know, that's when I know when it's out of my area and when to bring in somebody to protect yeah. my client.
And on the other side of that, that's exactly where Ann comes in, because she's the one that's going to be advising these company owners as to the appropriate benefits that cover a lot of this
right.
Of this workers' compensation. Because workers' compensation, very often the business owner doesn't know about as much about it as the business owner's insurance company and those people.
That's a good point too. Wow. Well, this is awesome. I love hearing this stuff. Tell me a good day in your book. What would that be?
A good day in my
yes.
book?
Yeah.
I guess it's when, you know, everybody's getting benefits. People go, you know, they get a surgery they get to a doctor that they just love. Mm-hmm. And when they call me and say, yeah, thank you for finding, you know, that right. doctor, finally somebody listened to me. You know, I feel like, you know, everyone was just writing me off. Yeah. You know, that's a great feeling.
Right.
Obviously if you reach a resolution and the client is happy, I mean that's a, you know, that's obviously a great day for everybody.
Right. Right.
But I love when I can find somebody, a good doctor, and the doctor figures out what's wrong with them,
yeah,
you know, and they'll finally be like, I thought, you know, I was feeling like I was, you know, everyone thought I was crazy.
Right.
And he figured out what was wrong with me. So I love when I hear that.
So you do have some good relationships with some good doctors then?
Absolutely. Yeah.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. Well, good. Go ahead.
Oh, and I was just going to add something you touched on earlier, the two tracks of personal injury and workers' compensation. Very often, a workers' compensation lawyer and a personal injury lawyer will benefit both of their claims by working together mm-hmm. because there's a lot of collaboration and combination of efforts. So you guys can both benefit off of the same medical reviews and deposition testimony
yes.
and liability issues. Specifically in like the example of a products liability suit, if you've got someone who was injured by some inherently dangerous machinery at the office, that's going to be that products liability suit, but you're still going to make sure that they are taken care of from the employment perspective for the workers' compensation.
Absolutely. That's what we're doing now, making sure he gets his medical treatment. My concern right now is to make sure that he's getting better and he's getting the treatment that he needs.
Now, I'm going to ask you the tough issue. What happens if I really like my job and my job's injured me? And I know this is where it gets kind of tough for clients.
It does. I mean, you need to file the claim because if you're going to be off, you know, you need to get those benefits. Unfortunately, 9 times out of 10, you can love your job. And when you have an injury, it's just sort of, it turns nasty. And not even due to any injury, you know, the injured worker didn't ask to be injured.
Right.
But the tone is sort of hands off, you know, nobody calls. And the biggest complaint I get, I probably wouldn't have a job if people apologize, because I get people calling me all the time and said they just didn't call me and say, how you doing? You know, and I feel like they abandoned me. Mm-hmm. And I loved working there, and this breaks my heart. And I mean, that's literally what I hear all the time. Mm. And I know they probably don't want to reach out because they're concerned about liability, but a little bit of, you know, how you doing goes a long way.
Absolutely. And that employee-employer relationship gets really delicate when there's a lot of money and a lot of benefits, especially in large-scale employers, where the actions of this one injured employee can reverberate across the entire labor pool. These are really important issues, and that management-employee relationship is delicate with these kinds of cases.
Yeah, and sometimes the employer seems to take it personally that they filed a claim against them, and it's like, you know, they didn't want to, but they had
to. How dare you?
I know, right?
How dare you?
He's like,
you're supposed to get hurt for me, and I get away with it.
Exactly, yeah. And they take it like that's why you have insurance, you know. And my client didn't ask to be injured. Do you think he wants to work, you know, laying down on a lap with his laptop? I mean, no.
It always did kind of blow my mind when I'd speak to people injured on the job about, you know, I don't want to sound too East Cobby privileged here, but talking about basic blue collar hourly jobs, and people, man, sometimes that's been a career for them. I look at it as, you know, laying carpet or working a mill. To me, that's not the most exciting thing, but I didn't walk a mile in that client's shoes. And to that client, this is a great blue-collar job.
Yeah.
This is a great white-collar job that they don't want to lose. They don't want to ruin these relationships, especially when you get into some of these small mill towns in Georgia and some of these areas that are dominated by one particular employer or another. It really will reverberate through your job, into your church, into your home, into your school, into your community. Those are tough relationships.
Yeah. And I wish I had better news, but I'd say probably 9 times out of 10 when someone gets injured at work, they don't go back. Well, they don't go back to that job. They either get fired or, you know.
Find something better.
The employer resents it.
They don't go back. They don't want the liability of the employer coming back. A lot of times they get fired. And also in Georgia, which sort of blows my mind, if we end up resolving the case and settling it, the employer typically requires a general release of all claims and a resignation as a condition of settlement, which blows my mind because in California, that was a fine. I mean, you could never, it was a retaliation, you know. So I moved here and they said, well, you get a resignation with that. And I'm like, what? So, but it's standard here. So you're not going back to the job. So you better get a lawyer because you're probably not going back. And it's just, it's not fair, but
it's a harsh
way
reality.
But
while I definitely recognize how it's great for businesses to be a right to work state, the rights of the individual certainly kind of take a second row seat to the rights of these businesses. And I know how the winds go here in Georgia. We're trying to get more jobs here than anywhere else. Governor was just overseas pitching some more movie jobs. But it is really hard when employees realize that they are a disposable commodity for a lot of these big companies. It's easy to fill that slot with another person with a similar skill set if the skill set's not too technical.
And they are shocked. You know, they'll say to me, well, how can they do that? How can this be how can this be fair? How can this be legal? And I'm like, well,
it is.
It is.
It's the same thing.
That's our law. You know, we don't have a lot of penalties for it. And so there's not a, you know, the employer's just, it just, there's no disincentive because the penalty is just not the severe.
Cost of doing business. I'd rather just pay a couple thousand bucks and be done with it. Similar to the employment discrimination, we get tons of calls, as I think every lawyer in Georgia does, about my boss is discriminating against me, X, Y. And I turn around and go, well, this is how we describe discrimination in Georgia.
Well, Georgia's an at-will state, right? Well,
yeah, yeah. And I tell them, they can't fire you because you're a woman. They can't fire you because of your race. They can fire you because you have brown hair. And really is the status of employment in Georgia.
And it blows their minds.
Yeah, people just don't understand.
When it happens to them, then they're like, what? You know, but until it happens, you know, you just think, well, how can this be? You know.
Yeah, well, you're typically not entitled to your job.
Yeah. Tell me how, tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you. Kind of got to wrap it up here.
Website, of course, workcompgeorgia.com, and Georgia spelled out. Beth at workcompgeorgia.com is my email. And you can find all the information there. I'm in the Cumberland area, but we do go all over the state.
And so. You're at WorkCompGal on Twitter.
WorkCompGal, yeah, I am. WorkCompGal. I know. Yes, on Twitter.
Well, another great one, Josh.
I love doing this. I love the guests that you're able to get here. I think I learn something new every day.
Me too.
And that makes me a better lawyer for my clients. I want to thank Emily and the good people at Petrie Offices, along with Rich Casanova, and the crew here over at Business Radio X for hosting such a fine get-together, and certainly our three guests. And again, will you tell us just a little bit more about what you do, how we get in touch with you, and what's the right client? When somebody's supposed to call you so that you can be of most help to them?
Thanks, Josh. I think the easiest way is to go to my website, www.hambybenefitslawllc. There's a contact page. It has my phone number, my address. And I'm just, like I said earlier, moved offices to Peachtree office. So excited to be here in the heart of Buckhead. An ideal client for me is a small to mid-sized business in the Atlanta area, although I recently helped a multinational company with a California subsidiary. So I have worked out of state. ERISA is a federal body of law, so it doesn't have to be a Georgia company, but I like having one-on-one personal interaction with the client if possible. So small to mid-sized business.
And startups.
Startups that are growing and want to build better business benefits for their clients, legally compliant business benefits, or if they're in the event of a Department of Labor or Internal Revenue Service audit and they need assistance through that audit, if they've been penalized and they want to negotiate a reduction in that penalty or an abatement of that penalty, absolutely, I am glad to assist in those matters. But small to mid-sized businesses, typically ranging from two employees to up to 600, 700 employees. That's my sweet spot.
And I really want to stress to people that good benefits will get you the best employees.
Absolutely.
My wife works for a mega investment bank downtown. She's worked for four or five over the last decade. Those guys get a benefits package that just blows your mind when you see it. Paid
Absolutely.
Vacation, doctor co-pays are minimal. Surgeries on the house. You get a good benefits page.
On the house.
Yeah. Surgery for everyone.
Oh, it's how I had my stomach removed. It was fantastic.
On the house.
It is. You get a good benefits package, you're going to get great employees. And
Absolutely.
In order to do your benefits right, if your ERISA is not in a row, you're going to pay. Oh, you're going to pay.
That is so true, Josh. And there have been studies done, particularly after the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, as some know it, was passed, there were questions all through the country and statistics on what does this look like from an employee standpoint if the employer just paid the pay-or-play penalty. And pretty much across the board, the employee said, no, we want the benefits. We want these the health benefits and the retirement plan benefits. And you're absolutely right. If you are a business, small startup business, and you don't have those small, mid-sized company, and you don't offer those benefits, employees probably going to look elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Joe?
Yeah.
What? Joe's busy fielding
you?
Phone calls.
Trying to get something done. What's going on?
Go ahead and tell me how they...
Okay.
If you're a regular person and you've been really hurt bad, or someone that you love has been killed and somebody else did it, and then you call me. 706-829-6229. Joe Neal. Neal Law, NEAL-LAW.com.
Thank you.
And I will be there.
Awesome. Beth?
It is workcompgeorgia.com. My phone number is 404-445-8370. That's going to go directly to me. So I'm very responsive, and you don't have to go through a million layers.
Awesome.
And I really also want to stress that the business clients for Ann, this is somebody that the CEO can call, your HR director can call, your CFO can call. It's a call that needs to happen so that your business stays on the right side. And then for those individuals that have been injured, nothing will make you sleep better at night than having someone in your corner like Joe, like Beth, because their job is to go out there and fight for you. Your parents didn't give you the tools to go fight for yourself. You didn't go to school for that. That's what Joe and Beth do. They get up every day and they go fight for your rights as an individual. Because otherwise, the society will just blacktop you. They'll roll you down, they'll cover you up, and you'll be done. You're nothing more than some numbers. You need somebody to go out there and advocate for them.
And you'll be able to see all their bios online, all their information on the website in just a couple of days at AtlantaLegalExperts.com. This is Emily Rowell signing out.